Well, is there life after death? Will we be reunited with our deceased loved ones when we die? Can they communicate with us now? Hello from Heaven, the first complete study of an exciting new field of research called after-death communication. Up next, Bill Guggenheim on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Guggenheim and his former wife Judy conducted 7 years of research on after-death communication for their work, Hello from Heaven. During this time, they interviewed 2,000 people, collected more than 3,300 firsthand accounts of ADC experiences. Bill is on the board of advisors of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, a member of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and he presents workshops at conferences for bereavement support groups, hospices, churches, colleges, and many other institutions. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Bill Guggenheim. Hey, Bill, how are you?
Very good, George. How are you?
Good, good. Now, how did you get involved in this? Because that was not your chosen field in the beginning.
Well, I used to be a stockbroker and securities analyst on Wall Street.
Good move.
I'm from Long Island, Manhattan, and New Jersey. And we moved from the Northeast down to Florida in 1974. And at the time that all this began, it was 1976, we were living over in Sarasota. And I very much was a materialist. I did not believe in life after death. I used to argue against religion and all these types of topics very vehemently. And I was a materialist, and I was interested in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and making money and things like that, sort of a early yuppie back then.
Sure.
And then one day, Judy said, come on in. Bill Donahue has a special guest on a show who is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Now, I had heard of Elizabeth's name, but I really didn't know who she was at the moment, but I found out that she was the world's leading authority on the topic of death and dying, and she had written all the books. And so I was open to it. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I watched the show for an hour, and I have to admit, she was a very riveting speaker because she could look right at the camera and capture you. And it was a difference for an hour, you know, in my life, and then I went back to my office and resumed my interest in Wall Street because I was a private investor, and that's where my income came from.
Sure.
And, however, 2 weeks later, the same program ran again on a cable channel, and once again, Judy said, come on in and watch it, and this time, it had her name and address at the bottom. So as my big gift was to write a check to her, you know, and for in support of her work, unsolicited. And I wrote a check for all of $25, which is what people give to the Boy Scouts, the Heart Fund, or anything else, you know,
sure.
The, like little good deeds for the day kind of thing. And I mailed it off thinking that's that, and that's the end of that. And lo and behold, about 2 months later, I received a package in the mail of audio cassettes of her work called Lessons from the Dying Patient and an invitation to attend the five-day workshop. And by the way, my $25 check got me a set of tapes worth $40. So that was a good investment right there. And as far as the workshop went, I didn't know anything about it, and I was very flattered to be invited. And it was going to be just 2 hours away from me. I lived on the west coast of Florida. It was going to be on the east coast in North Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I felt very good about being invited and all that. But then I thought, well, who's going to be there? Doctors, nurses, social workers, clergy, all the people who work in hospitals, people who work with the terminally ill, and probably some people who are dying themselves. And I'm squeamish and I didn't want to be there. And so as time went by, I resolved that it would be a waste of space for me to attend. So I waited till the last day of registration, and I called her office, Elizabeth's office in Illinois, expecting to speak to a secretary. And lo and behold, Elizabeth answered the phone herself. It was snowing in Illinois that day, and I recognized her voice immediately, and I gave her my little excuse that, please, Elizabeth, thank you very much for inviting me, but, you know, don't waste a seat for me because it's limited number of participants.
Right.
Please give it away. And she said in her German accent, Bill, I think you should be there. And as I point out, if nothing else, I'm a pushover for dominant women. And so I said,
no need to go there, Bill, but that's okay.
If you say so, I'll come. And I showed up several months later. And instead of death and dying, it was really about life and living. And 70 people who are total strangers bonded together And as by the third day, we all wanted to go off to an island and invite our families and have an extended time of it for the rest of our lives and be in that reality of love and service to each other. And during that workshop is when I first heard one of these experiences, and it was by a woman whose 15-year-old daughter had been hit and killed by a car, and several months later, she had what she called a dream about her daughter and how they were sitting in a tree, and the daughter wore a particularly pretty outfit and seemed very radiant, very alive, very happy, and she came over to her mother, and they hugged and things of that nature, and this gave so much comfort to the mother. And then the daughter said, I have to go now, and she left. And I thought about it for a few moments, and it was certainly very comforting for the mother, and I was very happy she had had the experience. She was a nurse herself, and she expressed her experience very well. But when she used the dream, immediately I discarded it, because to me, dreams were not real.
Right.
Then she went on a few moments later and recounted how her 15-year-old son had looked up while he was doing his homework in his bedroom, and he saw his deceased sister standing there. And he was able to describe what she was wearing and saw the smile on her face, and she looked whole and healthy and all that. And this scared him a bit, so he ran out from his bedroom into the living room where his mom and dad were and said, Kathy's in my room, Kathy's in my room. And that was the end of the experience. And I thought about it a few moments, and very cynically I concluded, well, 15-year-old boy, dead sister, something's wrong here. Kid's probably, smoking a little marijuana, some drugs.
So still, even at this point, you're still kind of pushing this away.
Oh, I blew it away very easily. However, a couple of days later, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, keep in mind, she's a foremost authority at this point, in 1977, and she'd been nominated for the Nobel Prize for Peace. And earlier in her career, when she was doing her research, she incurred a number of enemies because she would go into a hospital to interview dying patients. And as it turned out, the staff of the hospitals were very much in denial because their attitude in the 50s and the 60s was, everybody's going to get well and go home. Even though when they had these large cancer wards and things like that in the hospitals in Chicago and whatnot, they really resented the fact that Elizabeth would go up to these people and speak to them and interview them and talk to them and things of that nature about dying, because nobody's going to die in their shift, was the attitude of the staff. So there's a lot of backlash against her work, and they called her the vulture lady, the death and dying lady, and they really wanted her out of there. And so she was going to write a letter of resignation from that work and let it go. And at that moment, she had an office in an office building, and there was a woman at the elevator and said, Elizabeth, may I have a few moments of your time? So they walked the hallway back from the elevator where Elizabeth had just seen somebody off and down the hall to Elizabeth's office. And Elizabeth, who's a trained Swiss-born German psychiatrist, did what she called reality testing, and she noticed many different, did a lot of tests and noticed one particular thing about this woman. She was not fully solid. And she looked very familiar, but she couldn't quite place her. This story has been, by the way, printed many different times and whatnot, but I hadn't seen it or heard it at that point at all. And they went into Elizabeth's office, and the woman said, you must promise me that you will not resign. Your work is far too important for you to ever resign at this point. Promise me that. Elizabeth said, okay, I will. I will promise you that I will not resign. Because she recognized that this woman had been a patient of hers who had died 10 months earlier.
Jeez.
Now, here's somebody world famous, and I didn't know it, but people came from all over the world to attend these works, 5-day life, death, and transition workshops. They booked them a year in advance. I didn't know any of that. I just walked in. And here's somebody putting her reputation on the line. She had no reason to share an experience like this.
I would guess, Bill, after that, she did not resign, did she?
She did not resign. And the woman elicited the same promise a second time. And Elizabeth was very canny, very quick, remembered there had been a minister in this woman's life before she had died, and who had played a large part in her dying process. And Elizabeth said, would you mind terribly writing a note to your minister? And supposedly Betty Schwartz wrote a note with a pencil on paper to the minister. And then she left and went out the door. Elizabeth paused a moment, then ran to the door, looked up and down the corridor, but there was nobody there.
Now, did she write the note through Elizabeth or on her own?
On her own, apparently. I've never seen it, but I've heard of it a number of times. And at this point, though, for me, it was time stopped. And as I said, if a pin had dropped, it would have felt like a crowbar hitting a concrete floor. I mean, this totally wiped out my whole concept of reality.
I could see that.
So, also, she flew Raymond Moody, the well-known researcher and author of the book Life After Life, a near-death experience,
and
down
a wonderful
to our workshop
guy.
From
wonderful
Virginia
person.
To Florida, just to talk to us on a Thursday evening. And so I got to meet Raymond and got to know about near-death experiences and things of that nature, too.
So at that point, Bill, had you really become the researcher yet, or were you
still studying? No. Okay. At this point, I came home from the workshop, and I was very curious to know about these experiences. They had no name. Of course, there was no internet back in 1977,
right.
No computers or anything. So I would go to the libraries, and I'd look for books, magazines, articles, anywhere I could find them on the topic of anybody having any experience with someone who had died.
And you're still the stockbroker investment advisor?
Well, no. At this point, I was just working for myself, so I'm doing investments for myself.
All right.
And so I did have that luxury of having free time to do whatever I wanted to do, and I spent an increasing amount of time doing this kind of research, but I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a PhD. If I tried to write a book, who'd buy it? Nobody. I don't have the credentials because the books that were coming out on near-death experiences were all written by medical doctors.
Yes.
Raymond Moody and Melvin Morse and other people like that, and others who were PhDs. And if you weren't one of the two, forget it, unless you were an experiencer. But those books came out later, like Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light. Anyway, the point was that I didn't even think about writing a book, but I tried to get Raymond Moody to write one because I got to know him personally, and we spoke back and forth a number of times, and while he never said no, he never said yes, and it went back and forth for 11 years. And finally, by the way, in 1980, I had an experience of my own here.
What happened to you?
And what was happening, it was on a Sunday afternoon, Judy and I were living in the greater Orlando area, and we had a conversation on a Sunday afternoon in our living room in the front of the house, and each of us got up to go a separate way, and I heard a voice in my head by telepathy very clearly say, go outside and check the swimming pool. I'd never heard a voice in my head before. I'm just not into that.
Especially telling you to go out and check the swimming pool.
Right. Now, we had a screened-in pool, which is very common here in Florida, behind the house, and it's screened in, so leaves and animals and whatnot don't fall into it or anything like that.
Right.
And so I calmly walked from the front of the house to the back because there was no sense of emergency involved in the voice. And I noticed that when I looked through the sliding glass doors, about 15 feet away, we had a wrought iron fence with a gate in it, which was a safety gate because we had three boys.
Okay.
And the gate was ajar. It wasn't firmly fastened. And our two older boys used that as a shortcut to the backyard anyway. So I just slid the door open, walked to the fence to close the gate, and happened to look at that deep end of the pool.
And
there, our youngest son, Jonathan, 21 months old, was floating in the pool, face up, not moving.
Face up. Okay.
But not near the side or anything. And I just saw him. And, of course, I raced down the side of the pool. I screeched Judy's name aloud. And I, just before I jumped in the water, that I, for some reason, I took my shoes off first. I heard you're supposed to. And I looked at Jonathan, and then I noticed his eyes were wide open. He seemed to have a small smile on his face, but he was about an inch under the water. And he was not moving, not breathing, as far as I could tell, nothing. He wasn't thrashing. He was just floating. And I didn't know if he was dead or alive. So I went down under him a couple of times, pushed him to the side. Judy pulled him out by the hand. He was only 21 months old. He did not swim yet. And fortunately, we did not even require CPR because within 30 seconds or so, he coughed up some water and began shivering, and he was fine.
Oh, man, Bill, were you lucky?
And this was March, and the water was cold, and I was cold, he was cold, but we were all very happy that we did not have a dead.
My biggest phobia, children swimming in water.
Yes.
I guess since I was a younger parent, plucking my kids out of the deep end like you, except they weren't under for a long time, one fell off, another was, in an inner tube and slipped under. It is a phobia for me to the point where I can't go to a party if there are kids there because I spend all my time just glancing at the pool.
All right.
And with the kids, I can't settle down. So I can imagine the horror that you and Judy went through.
Yes, and but however, it did. It all happened very quickly. We figured out, by the way, he had come out a side door from a bathroom with a little, in those days, that had a little rubber handle you would put over the actual metal handle, and he wasn't supposed to be able to open it. The door was supposed to be locked, but somehow he had toddled out of that door toward the pool and walked over to it, lost his balance, and fallen in. But he had, even if he had yelled or splashed, I would not have heard him from the front of the house. And that if it were not for the message I received to go outside and check the pool, I never would have known he was in any jeopardy.
30 more seconds.
Oh,
yeah. Would have been a
definitely,
goner.
Definitely. So this was very convincing evidence for me that these types of experiences that I was reading about, now and then I'd find one, sometimes I'd find half a dozen, occasionally I'd find a whole chapter in a book. These experiences gained an incredible amount of credibility for me.
Build at that point, or how long did it take, or did you ever decide who was that voice?
I believe that that voice was my father, who died when I was 8 years old in 1947, which was 33 years earlier.
And he was just saying, save my grandson.
No, he just said, the words were very simple, and we found out later in the show, we wrote a whole chapter on these, but it's always an indirect message with no referral to danger. It's always stop your car now, or slow down now, or take a different road, or look out the window that you see a fire. Whatever it is, it's not a direct message. It's a slow, gradual warning, so it doesn't scare you into immobility.
But it kind of wants you to pick up on what happened.
Yes.
So in your case, then, it said just go outside to the pool? Or
yeah, it said go outside and check the swimming pool. That's all it said. That's all I heard. It didn't say anything about any danger or anybody drowning.
When did it hit you that something like this was happening?
As it happened. Yes, as it happened.
Okay, so you were picking it up right away. I mean, you were saying to yourself,
I heard the words.
This is unusual.
And checked the swimming pool, and I just did it because something inside me just automatically obeyed. I didn't question it. I did it. And by the way, I did encounter three or four people during the course of our research later on who did not obey that, and much to their despair, there was a death involved.
I want you to tell us about that when we come back from the break. How did you know, though, that this was an after-death communication as opposed to your intuitive or psychic ability, that little subconscious voice in our head that says, hey, do this, do that?
You recognize the voice of who it is. In this case, my father.
Okay.
And actually, it was 11 years later, or actually 8 years, 8 years later than this, but 11 years from the workshop. In 1988, when I heard the same voice again, because I kept trying to get other people to write the book, and I would provide money, and I knew a parapsychologist who was very well known, and he would find the people to be interviewed and all that. And we were trying to have Raymond Moody write the book, but Raymond became very interested and wrote many other books, but not this one. And I heard the voice said to me, do your own research, write your own book. It's your spiritual work to do. And it was very clear, very declarative. And stop talking, in other words, stop talking about it and go do it.
How long did it take you and Judy then to put Hello from
Well,
Heaven?
Then I called Judy. Judy and I had been divorced. We were married 17 years. We were divorced
for four years.
We had three sons. We went through the usual yuck, yuck, yuck stuff that people go through after divorce. But the good part is there is life after divorce as well. And we were becoming friendly. And I called her, and she came over a couple of days later. And as we were sitting there, a woman called who I barely knew and told us an experience about her aunt who had had some kind of unusual experience, who lived up in Tallahassee, and that a friend had visited her before the aunt even knew the friend had died.
Bill, stay with us. We've got so much to talk with you about tonight. Fascinating. Hello from Heaven is new research into after-death communication. I can't wait for your phone calls. Well, find out why so many people are beginning to subscribe to the After Dark newsletter. And also, when you're up for renewal, we're going to send you all a free gift, a CD of J.C. Webster ranting. You know, J.C., he's called the program for years now, first talking with Art, me, talks to Ian. He's a pest, quite frankly, but we've got him on tape, and we're going to give you that as our way of saying thank you for subscribing to After Dark. So you can do that by calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking Hello from Heaven. Hey, Bill Guggenheim, our guest. Tell us about some of these people who fail to take heed to the voice.
Well, basically, the one that stands out most is a woman who was told to go down to a dock, a little pier, which they had on their property overlooking, you know, extending out into a lake, and she didn't do it, and they later found that her son had dived off the side of the pier, and the water wasn't that deep or anything, but usually it would have been fine, but in this particular case, his head hit a rock, and he was knocked unconscious, and he drowned. And if she, presumably if she had gone down and heeded the voice, she would have arrived in time to at least be able to pull him out of the water and have somebody provide CPR, whatever, that kind of thing.
It's so a nightmare.
One message, in other words, I'd like to really say to your listeners, if you ever hear a voice in your or get a very strong hunch or intuition, what are you going to call it, the voice of the Holy Spirit or anything else like that, that says, please do this or don't do that, listen to that voice. It may take a few minutes of your time, but it may save someone's life, your own or someone else's, or protect somebody in some major way.
Now, let's get back to the question before the break. How do we know? Now, you said we recognize the voice, but not every after-death communication is someone we have known or loved.
Well, let me give you our definition of an after-death communication.
All right.
We purposely ruled out a lot of things because we had to, and we wanted to make our work unique. And so what we arrived at is the following, that an after-death communication, or an ADC, is a spiritual experience that occurs when someone is contacted directly and spontaneously by a loved one who has died, by a family member or a friend, somebody they've known who has died. Directly means that there's no third party involved. There's no psychic, no medium, no Ouija board, no device of any kind, and no ritual or anything. And spontaneously means that our deceased loved one chooses when, where, and how to contact us. So we ruled out purposely anything to do with hauntings and ghosts and all these types of experiences. We wanted to make it just family members and friends. A few cases they didn't know the person who was a family member. Might have been of their spouse or somebody like that, but they're able to identify them from photographs or verbal descriptions. But almost in all cases, they did know the person. So, and we made it narrow purposely so we would have credibility, and the people would operate within those parameters.
What percent of people who have had loved ones die have some kind of after-death communication experience with them?
Well, let me go a little bit bigger than that. First of all, our conservative estimate is that 60 million Americans, one out of five people, have had one or more of these ADC or after-death communication experiences. A poll was done by a Father Andrew Greeley at the National Opinion Research Institute that doubles those numbers to 43% of the population. So we're dealing with very high numbers here. In other words, one out of five or two out of five people. Now, if you're going to speak of, now, of course, many of our citizens have not been bereaved. Nobody close to them has died. So if you go into those who have been bereaved, it's probably one out of three or something like that. And there are studies that show that between husbands and wives who have been married many years, two-thirds of them hear from their deceased spouse. So it depends.
Those are huge numbers, Bill. Huge.
Huge numbers. That's why this is really the best-kept secret, because we just launched our research 12 years ago. So this is much larger than the field of near-death experiences, which have had all those books written about it and whatnot. And this is we regard this the exciting part, why I got involved. This is modern-day evidence for life after death. Beyond
off,
a doubt.
Off the wall question, but
yes.
Do people pick up communications of some form or fashion from their pets that they loved like people and children?
Yes, but we purposely did not include those in the book. We thought that would be too far out for Hello from Heaven for the first edition of it.
That's the follow-up.
We do have some in our files, and there are some other authors who are doing research on that. But yes, for those who are concerned about their, we have accounts in our files of dogs, cats, a rabbit, and even a horse who have died and come back. Yes. Let's stick with people for now.
what does this tell you about the other side?
What this tells me, we're running far ahead here, but it tells me
I'll bring you back.
I know. What I've learned, what I believe, is that the only thing that dies is our physical body. So people are not dead. Our bodies die. We bury a body. We cremate a body. And this language that we use in front of children, mommy's going to be buried in that hole in the ground, or grandma's going to be cremated. That's horrible language. It totally denies the beliefs of almost all religions that life does continue. And in our case, it's through a different form, but through after-death communications, we believe that. But we want people to see death as a transition, a doorway, and not a stone wall dead end alleyway, and as the way it is being presented to so many Americans. And that's why if you ask them, do you believe in this, that, and the other? Yes, they have Sunday school beliefs. But once someone close to them, a grandparent, a parent, a sibling, a brother, sister, a child, whoever is close to them, a friend who dies, usually their beliefs fall apart. And they're totally bereft, and they have to go through a horrible, long bereavement process, especially if it's a child who dies. It takes at least 5 years to begin to process all of that. And I don't want to imply an illness, but it is an emotional healing that takes at least 5 years, usually, for a bereaved parent. And I've specialized in helping them for over 20 years now.
Now, with the research that you conducted, tell us a little bit about how you did it. How'd you set it up?
Well, the very first year, I would go anywhere I could to find people to interview. And I'd give a little talk for 2 or 3 minutes at a class, at a church, at a group of any kind, any place. And I could tell by the smiles or by the heads that would nod that they'd had an experience. But I always had to go up to them. They didn't come rushing up to me. And I would get their name and phone number, and I'd give it to Judy, and we had another interviewer. And the first year, we didn't know if we'd interview, 50 people or 100 people. Turned out, we interviewed 500 people the first year.
Jeez.
And they're all over the place. And I'm a shy person. I back then especially, I was very introverted.
You?
So for me... For me to go and talk in front of a group was pure hell, because when I was in college, I literally put myself out of college because I had so much fear of public speaking. But that's another story. Anyway, I've changed because one of the ways I've grown because of this. And anyway, what's more important is that we found people wherever we went. I would try to find 10 people a week. I did. And as we went along, we interviewed more and more people every year. We interviewed 2,000 people for the book. We could have interviewed 4,000 or 5,000. It was just a matter of resources in terms of time and expense and everything else. But after a while, the experiences became so repetitive and so redundant. Even the words that people used were very similar. So 2,000 interviews, and we collected 3,300 firsthand accounts during that time. And we collated them all with a computer and everything else.
As you were collecting the information, were you then beginning to see some similarities here?
Oh, they fall into patterns so easily that you don't even have to have any training or anything like that. Remember, I'm not a scientist. I am not anything like that. I'm analytical, yes, but anybody can see that. In Hello from Heaven, our book, every chapter has about 15 experiences, which is every one is a complete short story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and not just excerpts. And anybody can see the similarities between the experiences in those chapters. We go from the more simple to the more complex, but nevertheless, they fall in very much into a pattern over and over and over again, according to the type of 12 major types of experiences that exist.
These people that you... rounded up for your surveys, did you have to pay them?
We didn't pay anybody any money. Matter of fact, we never paid even a dime for advertising. Everything was free. Everybody wanted to help us and believed in our work because we were sincere, and It was all, it worked out beautifully. What we did was we got our advertising into newsletters of bereavement support organizations on hospices, and actually we had newspaper stories during our research, which was unheard of. We had major stories, some of which were syndicated, and one story went into 26 newspapers in the United States and Canada, and it had our address and phone number, and people wrote to us or called us, and we had over 600 responses just from that one newspaper article. And so it just kept ballooning and ballooning, and people wanted this information, and we were invited to give our first workshop at a national conference for the Compassionate Friends 1 year after we began our work. The Compassionate Friends is the largest support group for bereaved parents in the United States, or in the world, actually. They have over 600 chapters in the U.S. I urge any mother or father or brother or sister or grandparent who's had a child or a brother, sister, or grandchild who's died to please attend the Compassionate Friends if they would really want to help themselves and deal with the grief that they're experiencing.
Of the people, Bill, who had these experiences, were they very spiritual or religious?
Just the opposite. It was just a cross section of people. You could go into any supermarket or baseball, you know, anywhere, almost anywhere that you would go, a university, just select people. They're just average, ordinary people. Some, the youngest was 8 years old, the oldest was 92. We interviewed probably more women than men. Not that men don't have these, but they're more reluctant to share them. At least publicly, you know, during a telephone interview or something like that. But it was just ordinary people. Many were blue collar, others were white collar. We interviewed more nurses than any other occupation. We interviewed doctors and attorneys, architects, all your professionals, you name it. We've interviewed somebody from ministers, from different people from all different professions. And we also had stories about us in the tabloids, the U.S. Inquirer and the Star, amongst others. And so that was a very different audience as well.
Now, what did the tabloids have to say?
Well, lurid headlines, voices, researcher records voices from the dead.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. That kind of thing.
Genghis Khan calls in, right?
Well, not quite. No, because we were not looking. We told everybody they were going to change their names. We didn't use any actual names. So if anybody wanted to have some notoriety, we said, forget it. We're not doing. We're going to change your name and all that. So there was nothing for them to gain from this.
You talk about 12 major kinds or types of after-death communication.
Mm-hmm.
What are they?
Okay, very briefly, I'll run through these. Most of these occur while people are awake, by the way, not asleep.
All right.
The most common one is sensing or feeling a presence. People just know that their deceased loved one is nearby, and they can also often point to what area of the room. They know when the person comes and when they leave, and sometimes it's a variation of temperature. It could be warmer or colder, although usually, typically, it's not. And however, if these occur during the first week or two after somebody's died, it's the one that they're most inclined to blow off and dismiss and say, well, so-and-so just died, Aunt Mary or Grandma, you know, Betty or whoever died. Well, I guess I'm imagining this. But again, this kind of experience of sensing or feeling the presence or any other kind I speak about can occur many years after the death. So it's not just imagination at the time of the transition. Another a very large category is hearing a voice. Some people hear a voice like we do on Earth through our ears, but the majority hear it by telepathy. Telepathy. There is mind-to-mind contact, the way I heard the voice in my head from my father telling me to go out and check the swimming pool. And some people have learned how to have two-way communication, and a few, usually husband and wife who are very close for many years, have learned how to have ongoing communication and with their deceased loved one, their deceased husband or wife. I ran into a woman one time who said very casually, oh yes, my husband died several years ago, but we ran a business before he died, and now I speak to him every night, and he advises me exactly what to do, and we're still running the business together. It's that casual in some cases.
Is the deceased getting any comfort out of this communication as well?
I believe that many people will thank God for sending their loved one back, or thank God for allowing their deceased loved one to come back. And I think that those who have died, think about it just as human beings, if we knew somebody was grieving because of they lost communication with us, and we could show up on their doorstep and say, here I am, I'm okay, you don't have to worry about me, I love you. Isn't that reward enough? They don't want us to grieve because they know we don't have to. They can still continue to exist. They're okay. They're healed. They're whole. They're fine. And they're trying to let us know that too. And the big payoff, the bottom line, especially for bereaved parents or anyone else where there's a love attachment, they want us to know that when we make our transition, when it's our time to cross over, that they'll be there to assist us and to greet us and to have reunion with us when we do so. And that's the big message of all this.
Why haven't they moved on? I mean,
They do move. Well, first of all, they're in the spiritual dimension in which everything we understand is there is no time and no space as we understand it. But they can just be here for a few moments and then there forever, and then come back. In other words, you can just like us. I mean, if you can watch a baseball game, but or be at a party, but you are keeping your eye on the swimming pool, right?
Right, right.
We can be aware of more than one thing at one time, and you can be reading a book, but you can be listening for certain sounds around you and things like that. We all multitask, and I think they're doing that. And they don't keep coming back for years and years usually, unless there's a real need to at a specific time. But most of these occur during the first 2 or 3 years.
Do they explain what it's like on the other side?
Basically not. Most of these are very brief visits, and I'm going to say it's more like a telegram of 50 words or less, and letting me continue with the 12 types of experiences. Another category, a small one, is feeling a touch. Some people... This would have to be between two people who are very close to recognize who was touching them. But it could be a kiss on the cheek or tussling the hair or an arm around the shoulder or the waist or something of that nature, a tactile type of experience. But again, it's a small category, and most people wouldn't recognize it unless they had a very strong relationship beforehand. But this all denotes affection, nurturing, and love. Then the most interesting one in some ways is smelling a fragrance, in that you can smell a cologne, an aftershave lotion, or a perfume of the one who died, or their favorite flower, favorite food, any kind of scent. And what's most interesting about these is that there can be a witness who doesn't know anything about what's going on, and that even if you say nothing, the witness could come along. And if you're smelling, say, lilacs, and you're in the state of Minnesota, and it's December, and there's not a lilac anywhere, or perfume or cologne or flowers or anything, and they can say, you know, go sniff, sniff, and say, where are these lilacs I smell? And a third person may come along, and a fourth person. We have one experience in the book in which 12 people all smelled roses when there were no roses at all present. So these are experiences with a witness, so they're not just subjective, limited to one person.
Bill, what is your website?
It's www.after-death.com. So it's after-death.com.
Hello from Heaven. Where do you get it?
Any large bookstores such as Barnes & Noble or Borders or whatnot, but especially from Amazon.com. Amazon is the easiest way to order it.
Bill, lots more to talk with you about next hour. Then in our third hour, we'll open up the phone lines, and maybe we'll get some of these ADC, after-death experience stories as well. Bill Guggenheim, our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM, co-author of the book Hello from Heaven. We'll be right back. Don't go away.